From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Australia's relations with the United States, our most powerful ally, and with China, our key trading partner, were both in the news last week. There are various opinions about Kevin Rudd's future as Australian ambassador in Washington if Donald Trump recaptures the presidency later this year. That follows Trump's sledge of Rudd in an interview with right-wing commentator Nigel Farage. In earlier times, Rudd had been a trenchant critic of Trump. On another front, the visit by China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi marked a further step in the improving bilateral relationship. To discuss these and other issues, we're joined today by Kim Beazley, a former Labor leader and a former Australian ambassador to Washington. Kim Beazley, do you have confidence that Ambassador Rudd could serve under a second term of President Trump without too many problems?
I have hopes that he could serve under a second term of President Trump, if there is a second term, which I also hope does not occur. I think you've got to remember, ambassadors don't see much of presidents. We do when we're accompanying the Australian Prime Minister somewhere, but aside from that, we see people much more lowly positions than presidents. And I think that would apply with the Ambassador Rudd in his situation now. So firstly, I don't think he'd come across him. Secondly, I don't think that having watched that interview that he did with that hairy Brexit character, Farage, I don't get the impression that Trump had heard of Rudd when Farage asked him those questions. He is now aware of it, and he wasn't aware of it before, so thanks to whoever it was who presented Farage with that question. I would hope that he would be able to continue. He works very hard on the Congress. He's very hard on Republicans and Democrats in Congress. He's really seized of AUKUS, and he's got a good work ethic. So I think Ambassador Rudd's going quite well now, so it'd be a shame if he was disrupted.
Now, you were ambassador to the US during the majority of the Obama administration, and you served both Labor and Liberal governments then. How relevant is an ambassador's political alignment, and how relevant is that of the government they represent in the United States?
The political alignment is less relevant than knowledge of politics. So I could serve both a Liberal government and a Labor government equally well. What counted for me was that I was had been in politics, gave me a concept of a very broad mandate. The fact that I'd been a minister gave me a comprehension of how I should relate to most of the administration officials that I dealt with. That I was a member of the House of Representatives was excellent background for dealing with congressmen. Congressmen really don't want to deal with ambassadors, let me tell you. They are a co-equal branch of the government, and you have to get on very well with them in the US. But on the whole, if you're an ambassador, you're just a nuisance. They have to spend all their time raising money and raising votes, and you're not helpful with either. I was advised well when I started, and I suspect Rudd follows these precepts too, and that was never go and see a congressman just to pass the time of day. If you're going to see a congressman, go to them either with a question you want to ask them or a proposition that you want to put to them. Because if you're not doing that, you're wasting their time. So I think I strongly suspect that Ambassador Rudd in various ways follows those precepts as well, and therefore he would be capable of serving either a Labor or a Liberal government well in Washington.
Of course, the ambassador has a very nice house in Washington, and I think uses that to try to bring people together and attract some notables, is that right? I seem to remember being at a gathering there with a travelling prime minister where the ambassador of the day got quite a few reasonably important people to come along.
Do lots of that. I used to do lots of that. Each week I'd do half a dozen of a breakfast, lunch, dinner, reception, and you'd have notables coming through non-stop. I had that all the time. And I think from what I understand of Kevin's tenure, he does much the same. Yes, it is an excellent residence. He's got one advantage that I didn't have. He now has a fabulous embassy. Mine looked rather tired and run down. The new embassy is a spanking bright thing. I would have used that embassy much more than I did the embassy that I had.
But the lesson is that the political movers and shakers are always up for a meal or a drink. Is that the message?
That's absolutely right, and that helps a lot. I used to have a rule, for example, that I would never serve Grange to Australia. I had some very good wines, and the Grange was the peak of them, but that was kept in reserve for Americans because you wanted to impress them with our very best. In the case of Australians, they were happy enough to take what else was around. So you work through your entertainment pretty conscientiously.
That's diplomacy for you. Now, more generally, how do you think the Albanese government would cope if there is a Trump presidency?
Well, they'd have to. I mean, I think the Prime Minister understands completely because he's an immensely experienced politician. And we don't just pay lip service to this, we believe it. And that is that we assume that whether you're a Labor or Liberal government, you get on with an American administration, whether it's Democratic or Republican. You've got to operate on that basis. It's not our business whom the Americans elect as president. And therefore, you want to keep an alliance going. You respect and relate to whoever the American people put forward. That's the attitude you have to start with.
Now, turning to AUKUS, as a former defence minister, how do you think AUKUS is progressing in the US and the UK? We're committing a lot of money to both those countries to buy the technology. We heard the announcement the other day of multi-billions for the UK. What's the state of play here?
Pretty good. You know, it waxes and wanes, but at this moment, there is an American SSN sitting at HMAS Stirling. This is now becoming a very frequent occurrence. People think it hasn't started. It's started. And there's a stack of Australians who've gone over the train in using and maintaining nuclear-powered submarines. There is the beginning of work on Stirling to be able to host more permanently nuclear submarines than is the case now, though nuclear submarines have been coming to Stirling since about 1981. So there's a lot of experience with handling them and the Navy in the West. We who live in West Australia are cursed to or maybe benefited by having very little understanding of what happens here in the eastern states. Very little understanding of our minerals industry, very little understanding of the defence priorities here in West Australia. In many ways, we're the alliance state. The mining is important to the Americans, but more than that, there's a joint facility here, several joint facilities now with space, and we've got a base that can carry American nuclear submarines here. So all of that added together, we are more used to it. I think we will get the workforce in place. That's not to say that it won't require a bit of an effort and it won't be a close-run thing. It'll be all of those things. But we're getting it together.
You're sounding very much like a defensive Western Australian there, Kim Beazley. You'll be defending the GST deal next.
Well, if you want me to, I will.
No, no. Let's stick to the submarines. Now, a purchase of these submarines is involving both the UK and the US. Wouldn't it have been better, in fact, to get them all from America? Or did the needs of the local shipbuilding industry dictate this rather unusual and complicated arrangement?
Look, if you're going to sustain submarines in your fleet, it is best if you can produce them. Because if you can produce them, you can certainly repair them. You get really full knowledge. And that's the first thing. The second thing is I don't think the Americans could sell us enough submarines. They probably can sell us two or three, might in extremity get up to five, but that'll be a struggle. I think there's an expectation on the American part that we'll do it for ourselves. It's a huge concession, the American decision to sell us submarines. They've never done that. They didn't sell the British submarines. They sold the British technology. And that was as far as they were prepared to go. To actually sell us one of their crown jewels it's like, the royal family taking a couple of diamonds out of the crown and saying, oh, look, Australia, you can, at a reasonable price, you can have these. That's it's the main, the focal point of American strategic dominance. And there they are. They're going to sell three of them to us. So I think we're pretty lucky in that regard, and we need to get on with building our own.
One of the biggest critics of AUKUS, of course, is Paul Keating, and he's critical of the alliance generally as it stands. You know Paul Keating very well, obviously. Why do you think his views are so different from those of the current Labor Party or Labor government?
Don't think he comprehends contemporary defence. Don't think he comprehends the contemporary character of American power and effectiveness, or our level of dependence on them. I mean, it's very hard. Back in the 80s, we had a very different perspective. We had the capacity to defend ourselves with the equipment, some of the equipment provided by the Americans and with their intelligence. We dropped the ball on that. We dropped the ball in the 90s and dropped it even further in the noughties. And we now find ourselves in a situation we can't really defend ourselves without the United States assisting. And it's a complex question, but I'd say this. Back in the 1980s, we find ourselves now, if you like, as far removed in American technology capability from where we were in the 1980s as we were in the 1980s from the Battle of Trafalgar. There's just been an exponential increase in technological capability. And it all resides in the United States. We couldn't target moving targets for the rockets that we get without accessing the American satellite system. I mean, it is just totally vital to us now. I don't think that those of us who are in politics in the 80s have really caught up with that.
Let's turn to the visit by the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi last week. Marked a further warming of our relations with China. How do you see the significance of this visit, and how difficult do you think it will be in future years to balance the opportunities of the China relationship but the undoubted threat that China will present?
Well, always a challenge. I mean, what we're trying to do, and we're not alone in this, the Americans are too, we're trying to keep a situation where nothing goes wrong. The Chinese end up respecting what the maritime borders of the South China Sea is, that they decide that any unity that comes with Taiwan will be a product of a negotiation, not force. We wish the Chinese well, absolutely. But there are lines in the sand that you have to draw in all these things, and they go to good order in international politics, basically. And we think the Chinese ought to be as interested in good order as we are, and that they're quite capable of being as interested as we are. So we ought to present an open hand and face to the Chinese, but we also ought to not mislead them on what we think is important.
Paul Keating also met with the foreign minister. Was this an example of the Chinese trying to just create a bit of embarrassment for the government?
I think it's more complicated than that. The Chinese always believe strongly in acknowledging their friends. And so you used to find that the didn't matter who was in office, the Chinese always reached out to Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger, but particularly Richard Nixon. Because back in the late 60s, China and Russia fought a war along the Ussuri River. And I don't know the exact details of the story, but apparently the Soviet Union asked the United States and said that it's got to a point where we want to use tactical nuclear weapons against the Chinese. And would you mind if we did? To which Nixon responded, we would mind and we would take an interest. And the Chinese knew that, so they were aware of Nixon in that regard, but also aware of Nixon's and Kissinger's outreach to them when they were in office. So they were always, Nixon was always important to them. I think Keating, certainly Hawke was, but Hawke's now passed away, but Keating was prime minister and minister who did many things with the Chinese. The Chinese would take the view on the whole that they need to keep in touch with him, that that you have to honour old statesmen. And so I don't think, I know all of us have been wandering around talking about the mischief-making, but I think there was less mischief-making there than meets the eye.
Now, just coming back to the government, you were leader of Labor when Albanese first entered Parliament. In the old days, you on the right and Albanese on the left would have been on different sides of policy fights. Are you surprised how he's evolved ideologically, about how pragmatic and centrist he's become?
Well, he was always a really terrific member of my front bench, Alba, and it was great to have him there and watch him develop as a politician. He's always been a pragmatist. That's the first point. The second point is, when you get to the position that he is in, you understand that the survival of Australia is not guaranteed, that the changing circumstances around us are not necessarily in Australia's favour, that having an open heart and mind to the region around us does not guarantee you that there won't be a change at some point of time in somebody's mind, in somebody's view. And when that comes, if that comes about, you need to have an effective deterrent. And you don't have to be a left-winger or a right-winger to understand that. You do actually have to be a knowledgeable person to understand it, and he does. So he doesn't run around playing games with foreign policy, striking attitudes, make it as though they matter a damn. They don't matter at all. What matters is outcomes, effects. And he is anxious to see the country for which he's responsible capable of defending itself, and it can't defend itself unless it goes along with the stuff he's talking about.
What about domestic policy?
Well, domestic policy, you do tend to find in Australia that domestic policy operates off a very narrow band. It's one of the blessings of being in Australia. Nobody is wandering around with revolutionary attitudes and trying to kick over all the traces. You do try to prioritise, and he is, but you tend to find that the Liberal Party and the Labor Party talk about much the same things, even if they've got different conclusions. We're not talking about nuclear energy, which is a very oddball thing for the opposition to go off with, but they do, on the whole, talk about the same things. And we have the best democracy in the world, and I think we have the best democratic practice in the world, and countries like us are becoming few and far between, which is a great shame, but also a challenge for us.
Western Australia, of course, considerably helped Labor to power at the last election, and some say that it won't be able to hold on to those seats that it won last time, even though it's pretty vital that it does if it's to avoid minority government, probably. What's your view? Do you think it will travel well in the West again as well?
Well, we're a long way from the election, and so I put that as a qualification. You don't know what black swans there out there are going to descend across your footpath. But if everything stays as it is now, Labor Party over here hasn't actually annoyed anybody. You know, by and large, you've had a very sensible and effective state government. As far as the federal government's concerned, it's done nothing that really annoys West Australians. There'll be, I think, it'd be wise to allow it to occur, a West Australian election before the next federal election, next March. I think the Labor Party will win it quite substantially, and that would be a good 2 or 3 week run into the federal poll, and I think we'd hold everything.
And just finally, in those days when you were working closely with Anthony Albanese, did you spot him as a future Prime Minister?
Well, I certainly spotted him as a future leader. As a future Prime Minister, that's in the lap of the gods. You know, the timing has to be perfect and all the rest of it, it was for him. So he's always had a capacity to lead. So a few other people in the Labor Party had a capacity to lead. But his capacity was drawn on at precisely the right moment.
So you need luck as well as talent to get to the top.
Totally. There's no question about that.
Kim Beazley, thank you so much for talking with us today and sharing your insights. That's all for today's Politics Podcast. Thank you to my producer, Ben Roper. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.